All right, good morning, everybody. Thank you for making it here in the inclement weather. Maybe bad for California, but when you think about other parts of the country, we're doing pretty well. So welcome to this meeting. It's an exciting discussion we're going to have today, and we're delighted to have Star here. Let's see if I can get this going here. Nope. All right, well, let's go to the next slide. Okay, for those of you who are not aware of the Aerospace and Defense Forum, I can't stand still and talk. So we're a 12-year-old organization. Actually, it's probably a 13-year-old organization. 2,500 professionals. Facilitates communication, collaboration. And I noticed this morning a lot of people talking, meeting. That's exactly what we're about, meeting people. And I encourage you to continue to come as we continue to have meetings throughout the year. There's 9 chapters across California, Arizona, Texas, newest chapters in Ventura County. Our meetings are presentations such as this. We're going to have tours coming up. We'll have a tour of ITT coming up. We'll have a tour of the Advanced Technology Center coming up and some other tours and other presentations. And it's about leaders getting together, learning about each other, learning about tools and connections that will help them run their business better and be more successful. Now, if you haven't put a business card in, please put a business card in. We'll make copies of those and send those out to everybody. So please place your business cards in the bag, in the basket. We'll go to the next slide. We were fortunate to have made it through the pandemic with the help of the SCV EDC. We continued to go, and they have been our sponsor and really an extremely good partner for us as we're working together to improve things in Santa Clarita. So I'm going to introduce Jay, who's going to talk a little about the SCV EDC, and then we'll move forward.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the applause. Wow, first time applause. This is awesome. No, thank you. Pleasure to be here. We are partnered with the Aerospace and Defense Forum. And as part of the Santa Clarita Valley chapter, it's important for us to engage our aerospace and defense community. I do want to do a special call out today. We have a member who's been with us for quite a little bit, but she has found a new location here in the Santa Clarita Valley. So one of the things that we do is we help companies like Nycote to find locations where they can make themselves feel at home here in the SCV. There's a lot of aerospace and defense organizations that they may already be working with. It makes a lot of sense for them to be based here in the Valley. And so one of the main priorities that we have as an organization is we help to attract and retain businesses to continue to build and offer high-paying jobs. We are very unique in that we are funded by LA County. We are also funded by the city of Santa Clarita. And we have 50 board members who represent some of the largest companies across the Santa Clarita Valley. In fact, our co-chair is here today. If you didn't get a chance to say hi to him, he's sitting there in the back. His name is Calvin Hedman of Hedman Partners. And we also have another board member here. Yep, Gary Sanger of Sanger & Associates. But it's always a pleasure to be here because we also welcome other partners that helped Santa Clarita Valley grow. We have a couple of representatives here with our Employee Training Institute. That includes Jeff Greger sitting there in the back and also Justin Wallace here with the Employee Training Institute. They are part of College of the Canyons, and they help to design the programs of the future that help our aerospace and defense population to groom. And I'm also joined by a couple of special guests here, a few. I've got our staff members here really quick. We've got Scott Heffernan. They didn't think I was going to do this today. And then we have Lenise Renfro. She's running the show back there. But we also have Andre here. Andre's going to get up and talk a little bit more about workforce development because it's important to understand how everything that we try to do as an organization with our partners is really going to be focused in the future on how we train, get our workforce ready for the next level, and how we create higher paying jobs. So please help me welcome up Andre Seltzer. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. And good morning, everyone. It's really good to be here. I'm sorry I brought the rain with me from England, but I'm now part of the community and really enjoying being part of Santa Clarita Valley EDC. So as Jay mentioned, I'm the VP of Workforce and Economic Development. My role is to support the companies here, identifying their workforce needs, challenges, pain points, and identify where we can work with our partners like College of the Canyons to reduce costs on currently existing training opportunities for employees, look at some of the new employees coming in and talent pools with our partners like the AJCC. But also, you know, we have our internships as well. So we have so many partners here, and I'll tell you a story. So my background, I originally worked for the Arizona Commerce Authority. I did a lot of work on semiconductors, worked on the TSMC fab. And with that work, you know, one of the critical components in these large projects is workforce. And if you don't get your workforce right, you could delay production and development and really bottom line cost to the company. So one of the things that we're looking at right now is a local community in Santa Clarita, companies that potentially are looking elsewhere. Can we be that alternative opportunity in looking at workforce as a key access point? So site selectors right now, one of their key priorities isn't just reducing cost and tax incentives. They're also the top 2 points of workforce development and workforce credits and incentives. So we have amazing partners here in California to really take advantage of that. We've got many of those folks in the room here today. Something also with STAR here today, it's a passion subject for me, thinking about AAM. I originally was also working a bit on vertiport development in different states. So one of the things I'd really like to hear from STAR today is a bit about what's going on now and how this can really impact communities like ours. We have some amazing companies operating in California, like Joby Aviation and Overair, and these amazing companies that are now receiving a lot of investment. They've done their special purpose acquisition corporations. They've filed IPOs. They're moving forward. And then you've got the infrastructure here. And I think if you've not thought about AAM before, think about it now, because this is an opportunity to take a two-dimensional, low-capacity infrastructure and make it three-dimensional, increase potential opportunities for Santa Clarita Valley, connectivity to downtown and other locations. So I won't take any more time up. I'd love to hear from STAR a bit more today, but thank you very much for the time. Cheers.
Thank you, Andre and Jay. So now it gives me great pleasure to introduce STAR, who has held various positions to help NASA mature the advanced air mobility ecosystem and focus on urban air mobility. She is the lead strategist, and she's responsible for maintaining a strategic view of the larger AAM ecosystem wide movement to include advances in industry aircraft, airspace, and infrastructure investment and capability. STAR led the planning, development, and execution of the AAM National Campaign Series, which consists of flight testing and experimental AAM ecosystem of novel eVTOL and cargo vehicles, infrastructure, and airspace management technologies in the context of increasingly complex safety scenarios enabled by automation. At one point, she was the AFRC ARMD Chief Engineer for 4 years and Deputy Aeronautics Research Director for 4 years to develop strategic roadmaps for AFRC in collaboration with all the NASA research centers on electrified autonomy to include projects like AirVolt, LeapTech, X-57, Heist, and Aquifer. She has 27 years experience conducting one-of-kind flight tests. She has a Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering and a Master's of Science degree in Aerospace Engineering. And with that, I welcome STAR to the podium.
Thank you. Oh, so am I going to click or are you going to? I guess you're going to click. It works. Okay. Thanks very much. Just a little bit more background. I mentioned maybe to a couple of people, but I am a high school graduate in the Antelope Valley. So I moved up to, my parents moved up to the Antelope Valley. I was born in Thousand Oaks. We moved up there when I was in eighth grade. I went to Little Rock High School. I got an internship after my junior year of high school at NASA. and then realize I want to be an engineer. What a cool place to work. And then I went to Cal State Northridge where I got my bachelor's. And then as I try to tell a lot of the interns that we get, you know, don't specialize too quick and jump into a master's. Most of the places you work will pay for that master's, but more specifically, you don't know exactly which job you're going to get and which emphasis you're going to have. And so to get into the workforce, get the experience, and then say, okay, now I want to get some more like theory behind what I'm doing hands-on, then go back and get your master's. And somebody else pays for it. It's great. So through all that, I started out in structural dynamics. So that's aircraft fluttering, like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge video that you see where it's rocking away. It's fine. And then I moved into a strategy position at NASA Armstrong. And so this idea of advanced air mobility began in 2012, where there was a couple of us nascent, crazy people at a couple of the NASA centers that said, hey, we need to really look at electrifying aircraft. Like, I think technology's come far enough that it could buy its way onto the airplane. So we put a proposal together. We got a very small amount of money. And because of the small amount of money, we went out and worked with small businesses because we could not convince any of the large aerospace companies to even think twice about this area. So so really, this effort has spawned a very different way than most advanced technologies in aerospace. And that is, you know, from small businesses. So Empirical Systems Aerospace ended up being one of our small businesses. They're in San Luis Obispo. Joby Aviation was one of our small businesses. When those businesses started, they were like three people, four people. And we had another company who did the battery system. They were like two or three people. Basically, all of these little small businesses are now, you know, hundreds, and Joby's, you know, thousands, and, you know, they've just grown and expanded. And this is the first time I've seen commercial money, like, you know, capital investment from the commercial sector, not the defense, coming into a new technology first. And so it wasn't until probably about 2017 that the Department of Defense decided, hey, we better get involved in this, because if we don't, this is going to become like the DJI drone industry, which ended up being developed in China and ended up not being an advantage to us as far as what Chinese put on their devices to sniff out everything we're doing here in the United States. So they made it a point to say, hey, we're going to look for a way to bring these technologies into the military so that we can keep the intellectual property here in the United States. So that was great. But what a difference of, you know, usually the defense is the first to pump in money for new ideas. So they're catching up. So it's been 11, 12 years now that I've been advocating for this work. And so I didn't know, does anybody know about advanced air mobility? Obviously a couple, but so these vehicles fall, these eVTOLs, so electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, fall in between the fixed wing and rotorcraft vehicle. So I always say if something is a hybrid, it's neither good for one or the other thing, but it kind of suits a different niche. So fixed wings, they go, you know, they can go fast. Our little Cessnas here, their wings are designed specifically around slow flight. So that's good for, you know, takeoff and landing. It's not good when you're trying to go high speed. So that big wing causes a lot of drag and high speed. So rotorcraft, obviously you have the opportunity to have smaller areas to get in and out of, but when they're up and away, they're very slow. So they might go like 90 knots. And yeah, these guys might go hundreds of knots, but you know, each of them have a deficit kind of at one part of the envelope. So if we decided, like, let's look at distributed electric propulsion, let's look at making a wing half the size. So when you're up and away, it's the most efficient. That's most of the time, that's where you are, is up and away, right? And then we also want the opportunity to be able to land vertically. And it's not really vertically per se. Most people picture, you know, these, when they look at these routes, they're like, okay, you know, this vehicle's going to come in. It's gonna like, elevator down. That's not how helicopters fly. They all have approach angles like fixed wing airplanes, but they can do steeper angles at slower speeds. So there were so many different, hundreds of different configurations of what distributed electric propulsion can do to open up the aircraft design space. So this was just completely novel for how you design aircraft. This picture was back in 2001. And this is how fast this industry is moving. Kitty Hawk's no longer, but I want to say a word about, I'm just like blanked on the guy's name, but the Google guy, which one? What are the two Google guys? Well, one of the Google guys used his own personal money back in 2009 and started a company called Zero. And he wanted to make personal air vehicles for himself, right? Get out of the San Francisco traffic. And then he started investing into a couple of companies, and Kitty Hawk was one of them. This was the original Zero configuration. It didn't get named Whisk until Boeing came in and started investing, like co-funded some of this development with the Google guy. I'm not a name dropper, obviously. So Larry Page. So it's not Google money. It's actually Larry Page's money. About 2012, we started working with Joby, and at that point they were just building motors. Like, he came from electric industry, just looking at new alternative methods of power. And so he was looking at motors. And so when we partnered with him, it was really for the motor part of this. And, so Bell was in it for a little while, but now I don't know if you guys have heard, Textron has decided to jump in, and they bought one of the most mature companies out there, which is Pipistrel, and they're in Slovenia. And they actually probably came before even Larry Page's money, because they started out there. And in Europe, everybody has a lot of noise issues. So building gliders or light-powered airplanes is easier to get a pilot's license and fly around. So they were looking at electrifying smaller aircraft. Then you have these other companies that are just looking at like package cargo delivery. That's Elroy. There's Beta. So this is another thing. So the FAA, is trying to figure out how to certify these vehicles that are neither a fixed wing or a helicopter. Beta started out a classical VTOL, but they decided their method, you could see they got a pusher on the back of the vehicle right there. They decided, let's just really push forward on the fixed wing side of this and understand the power and propulsion system, like stress test everything, and we want to put a pilot in it. So if you put a pilot in it, and you take out the having to do the transition from vertical to horizontal flight, your stability and control is much better known. And so pilots would jump in that a little easier. Joby, on the other hand, and a lot of other people decide, let's just start with no pilot on board, because we want to be able to get through this transition period, which is very complicated, and do quick software iterations with not a lot of, class A critical V&V of software, because we're putting a pilot on it. So everybody's kind of taken a different route. This is Electra Aero. They're doing a short takeoff and landing vehicle. So I think they say they can land within like 100 to 300 feet. So distributed propulsion across the leading edge. So a lot of these companies have come and go. So first we called this urban air mobility, because the idea was people were trying to get in and out of the urban environment without being in traffic. But then you start looking at all those different vehicles I showed, and they all kind of have different use cases. And so we decided, let's do more of an umbrella statement and not just specifically focus on eVTOLs, but also the people who are trying to, like I didn't point out, but the people that are trying to do highly automated vehicles. So the Cessna Caravan 28 is a workhorse for the FedExes and rest of the, package delivery companies. And so you have to have two pilots in this vehicle. So they're doing what everybody likes to say as they talk to the FAA, a crawl, walk, run. So they're looking at how they can prove out the automation with just one pilot on board. And basically he just kind of supervises the automation and then eventually prove out that system is certifiable. And now you have a remote pilot. Well, actually there is a remote pilot already. So the pilot sits here, doesn't do anything, he just drinks his coffee. And a guy that's like 100 miles away is flying the airplane. But eventually what they do, they'll take the pilots out and then you'll have a remote pilot, but they want to go beyond just one remote pilot for one airplane. They're going towards what people call an M-to-N. So some number of ground supervisors to a certain number of airplanes. So maybe you start one ground remote supervisor to three aircraft flying in the air to, you know, M-to-N. So just pick your number. These guys are really trying the hardest thing. I'm not really sure why they did that, but they have no pilot on board at all. But there's a remote pilot on the ground. So their use case is interesting. I mean, I think this is the best idea for this use case is tourism, air tourism. So anywhere you see air tourism, it's a very scheduled airspace. You know, there's one in and one out of different volumes of airspace. So there's just like this natural separation that's happening. And you already know where your obstacles are, your path is planned. You do it day in and day out. So if there was a use case that you could start this in, that probably is what they'll do. And they started experimenting with that in New Zealand, actually, a couple of years ago. So you can see there's, you know, how do we get people like medical attention or for the cargo delivery? How do we get, like heart transplants or kidney transplants or something to hospitals quicker? There's like this buildup of where are these going to start? This is a fun, if you just look up NASA AAM playbook, there's all these little videos that just kind of depict, you know, what this industry is going to enable. So this is really a good educational piece. This one, ride quality, for instance, I think this one needs to go out in the community. I think like my next job needs to be going to different communities, you know, taking like a movable seat, you know, small movement, put VR goggles on people, you know, show them what it actually feels like to, you know, lift off and, you know, fly around. And there's noise in their headphones, so they get a sense of what inside the cockpit's going to be, and just get them just comfortable with this idea, because the view that you have in a vertical takeoff and landing airplane is very different from a fixed wing, because you probably will be in and around more obstacles or closer to obstacles than you would be in an aircraft. I would like put one of these in the United Lounge, right? It's the people sitting in the United Lounge are the ones that are going to be able to pay for these seats. And so while they're, you know, having their drink and waiting for the next flight, they could fly around one of these. So infrastructure, we'll talk about that a little bit more. This is where the idea started. Obviously, wouldn't it be great if you could just go from your house to another spot? It could be your own personal airplane or just could be an air taxi, but that's not where it's going to start. So this is kind of a buildup of the future. Like, so this is an idea of where we want to go. And if I put a date on this, you know, it's like 2050. So, you know, it's something pretty far out there, you know, to get this amount of traffic that close and into obstacles and other, you know, other aircraft. But you can see like all the rooftops in Los Angeles aren't used anymore because helicopters are loud. I personally led the test, the acoustics test with Joby out where they're testing. And the vehicle is amazingly quiet compared to any other airplane you've heard. When you think about these operations, you have to think about what are all the bad things that can happen. So that's what we've been focusing on in flight tests, is not just the nominal, okay, the easy part is I'm going to take off, nothing happens, and I get to my next destination, but things always happen. And when one thing happens, it's usually a domino effect of other things happening because of that. So that's, you know, so landing and takeoff clearance, you know, all these things highly rely on sensors on the vehicle, but not all aircraft in our airspace has to have sensors to tell you where they are. Now, they're not going to be like in big city areas, but even if you get in a Class D airspace or something, I mean, you can still have airplanes that don't have to have transponders. And some of those are just like legacy, like they're old aircraft and they've been grandfathered to not have to have any kind of transponders. So a lot of what we have to think about is what we call non-cooperative cooperative aircraft. Not that they're trying to be mean, but they just don't have to have the sensors on them. So how do we see those? How do we replace the pilot's eyes to see those? Because even if there's a pilot on board, it's very hard to spot an aircraft when you're flying. And so what's the indications pilots are going to get, whether they're on the ground or in the cockpit, of how to miss these non-cooperators? What sensors do they need to do that? And a lot of all these yellow highlighted words are basically, you know, what kind of automation are we helping assist a human with that they normally handle those functions? What's the cadence of them coming in and landing? People come up with crazy numbers, but at the end of the day, it's the ride quality. So a passenger is not going to be acceptable to come speed in and land really quick in the landing spot to see how many you can get through. You got to come in very gracefully and take a little while to set down, right? And then, you know, what's the ground operations? Were they going to taxi? Were they going to let people out? So there's a minimum time that needs to be allowed just to do those basic applications. So, I mean, people think 5 minutes is too much. Some people would like to see 3 minutes every 3 minutes. But I mean, if you look at any airport, it has complaints from the community around it. And it's not just noise, but it's safety. If they just see an airplane that looks like it's flying erratically, even though they don't know how airplanes should look, how to fly, they'll make a complaint. So could you imagine you have this like normal traffic that comes in, but now you're saying, okay, every 3 minutes, I'm going to see something coming in and out, right? That becomes visual pollution to people. And so, I mean, these are all things that have to be considered. The other thing that's very interesting is psychoacoustics. Psychoacoustics is people's perception of what that noise means to them. And a lot of it has to do with, can they afford, if they could afford to buy a seat on these vehicles, they would not complain about the noises or the visual pollution because they're getting a benefit out of it. Lost like an hour and a half on the freeway. So everybody's like, yeah, I want to see those land every 3 minutes. Somebody who can't afford it is going to shut it down in a second. Those people can shut it down in a second. It doesn't matter if there's a million people that want it. The small majority always win when it comes to, you know, complaints in a community. So, as you can see there, you know, eventually there'll be these, you know, basically tubes in the sky that people are flying in, and you know, they touch any border of these tubes and there's warnings and there's all sorts of automated things that go on the telemetry vehicles. Like, I don't know, this guy's having, you know, maybe he's like low on his battery, didn't realize it. And he's got to get, you know, out of the tube and land as soon as he can. And now that just put like a disturbance in the whole rest of the flow of things. Cause at some point, you know, you got to transition him through some other person's airspace or whatever. So there's just, the contingencies are just really hard to think about. So if I say, okay, maybe when, so the other one I said 2050. So one of the places people would think about landing these vehicles was, you know, shopping centers have become obsolete with all the internet buying. So all these like outlet malls, you don't really see much outlet malls. It's kind of like ghost towns now. But that's huge infrastructure. And obviously it was placed, it's like somebody did the numbers and said, if I place it in this spot, I'm going to get the most people from all these different communities coming to this spot. It's like the most central location. So the community planning has already been done for shopping centers, but they're not being utilized. So why not have, you know, places for these vehicles to land, right? And then you have some of those companies can have other services that the aircraft need, or, you know, people, maybe they stop there because they wait to catch an aircraft to another place. And, you know, maybe think of it like when you're at a train station, like you get to one, we don't have this here, but if you travel in Europe and you are on a train station and you stop somewhere and you're waiting for another train to get on because you're going to another place, you know, you need amenities there or whatever. So it's just, you know, an idea. Actually, another place people were thinking of, like, what's the place that you have everywhere but is underutilized, just land that's underutilized? And they were saying, you know, where you get on the freeways where it circles around, there's just like this big open circular pad right there that will never ever be used. But, you know, there's a way for people to get there by a car, and, you know, you'd land one airplane there. So, I mean, just people thinking, what are all the different places you can use? But this is where we started. We started with, here's today's infrastructure, and this is where these vehicles are going to start. they want to get, they want to start doing operations early, they're going to have to fit in with the way the FAA has certification set up and operations set up today. So, you know, the Jobys and the Archers plan to have pilots, Beta plans to have a pilot. And we have all of our different airports. So we're just saying, even with our, so we have airspace rules and operations. So how do we integrate into those, but then maybe have helicopter routes today are very much like a visual flight rules. There's not a whole lot of instrument flight rules, helicopters that fly. So not a lot of helicopters that fly in weather. And you don't just use instrument flight rules just to fly in weather. You use instrument flight rules even on a very sunny day going to LAX because you want a high cadence of operations. You want to make sure you manage the spacing. You already know where all the obstacles are. So every airplane, even when it's sunny out, are using instrument flight rules. So, right, they've dialed in something. Somebody knows exactly where they are. They know exactly, you know, precision landing. So how do we take that idea of having instrument flight rules, but just applying them to these vehicles and more of where like our helicopters fly today? Now, of course, the helicopter community is going to be like, well, that messes me up because, you know, everything is with helicopters. What is it's like tribal knowledge is what one of a helicopter pilot told me. You know, anybody who flies a fixed wing knows exactly how they need to come into an airport, right? That's you learn that basic training. Helicopters, on the other hand, can come in, sort of follow those rules, but where they end up coming down and landing or taxiing is kind of just tribal knowledge for that airport and word of mouth how they do it. It's not something that's on, you know, an FAA book for that airport. But if we could put some more, just some more kind of rules in place for those routes, there's plenty of those routes that exist today, just in our national airspace. So the pillars of research that we're working on, so when we say ecosystem, it started with the aircraft. So we had X-57. I'm super excited that I was able to get that one funded at NASA. This was our first manned X-plane at NASA in 20 years. So we even forgot how you even got X designations. So I had to go research that. You actually get them through the military. So we did X-87 and we were looking, you know, looking at different motors and inverters and batteries and all the electromagnetic interference that happens when you have really high power electrical wiring in the airplane. You know, so they radiate this noise and you got to put instrumentation wiring right next to them so that you can communicate with the airplane, and that high power cabling puts noise on the instruments so you're not getting the right instrument readings. So now you got to figure out how you're going to do shielding of all that wiring, how you're going to bring the weight down. Now you got to, you know, everything's just weight. So there's that area. And as soon as we felt like industry was, you know, really making some advances there, and in NASA's budget, the first A is aeronautics. And it's probably like 3%, 4% of the budget. Very unfortunate, but that's all it is. So with and advanced air mobility in that 3% is probably like, I don't know, it's probably like 25% of that 3% budget. So we have to figure out like where's the best spot for NASA to lead things to get ahead of industry, right? So then there's something for us to transfer to industry. So we like buy down the risk for them. So we did some of that on the aircraft side. And by the way, we're just on the first generation of these aircraft. So there's still much more that NASA needs to be doing in advancing the technologies that go in the vehicle. But, you know, it's like, how do you bite all this off? So for these two kind of go together, airspace and infrastructure, in that they're looking at the operations around an airport and how that integrates in the current system. How do you do digital communication? So if we're going to increase cadence of these vehicles, ATC, the air traffic controllers are already saturated with the number of flights we have today. So that's, you know, for sure. So now we're going to add more flights. So we have to get rid of the communication. Like the time it takes to communicate is actually a long time. So if we can just digitally communicate where the aircraft is with another digital system, and get, that's like step one, get rid of the voice. That's pretty hard. And then we tried to study, like, you know, so what makes sense for the number of operations to come into a given spot. The thing that everybody's been lagging on is this community integration piece. And this is all like chicken and egg thing that's happening right now. So I started working with LA World Airports, like in 21, to say, hey, got the Olympics coming in 28. We got to debut some advanced air mobility vehicles. We had people on our team that had come from the FAA doing terminal area procedures. And I said, give us like 12 spots around LAX that, you know, you can land somebody, or maybe land somebody, at least the areas available on the ground. We will look at the airspace operations of how we get them into that area, and then how we get them, you know, to land. And there's obviously different noise, you know, footprints around that airport. And there's obviously the traffic set there. When the wind changes, that traffic has to, you know, change direction. So we looked at all that, and you know, I think just look at from Van Nuys, the Van Nuys flyaway. I mean, think of a real mole. I said, look, Lawa, you know, also, you know, owns Van Nuys. They also own the Palmdale Airport up there. But, you know, that Palmdale Airport has just never made it. I don't know why, but it just can't seem to make it. But if you could get somebody even just from Palmdale to the Van Nuys flyaway, and then they take the bus in, right? Let's not try any really hard airspace integration to go into a Class B airport, but just go into, you know, I think they're like a C or D airport. Just go in there, and then, because look how many people just drive and park just to ride that bus. I mean, that already works. And I don't, you know, the train or their metro system has so many stops, it just like ends up taking twice as long to get anywhere. So I mean, that solution, you know, doesn't necessarily work. But what's an easy, just to show like the community why you want to do this, why we can make it affordable and make it as simple as possible. But, you know, when I just talked to Lawa, because I was trying to get them on a panel for a conference I'm helping put together. And they're like, yeah, you know, we decided to not integrate advanced air mobility into the Olympics. And that's because these airplanes are still trying to get certified. So when I say the chicken or egg, it's like, yeah, people are like willing to do that. But that's a lot of investment to make. Like, and who's paying for that investment? These companies keep saying, oh, we're going to be certified in 24. Okay. 25. Okay. Now it's 26. You know, now we're going to be flying people in 27. Well, I mean, the more that slips, and that's just a one-off airplane, one type certified airplane. They're trying to get a manufacturing type certification, right? Their manufacturing process is predictable, and they're trying to use new methods of putting airplanes together, like robotics, like cars. Well, that's not proven for the aviation industry. So, you know, they keep trying to bite off too much instead of just like focus on making airplanes like people make airplanes today, right? Start getting the operations going, to start integrating and show like you're worth and you're safe, right? They got to build a whole safety record. So the first time one of these airplanes get out, or even when they're just testing, you know, we've had a few accidents, that's to be expected with prototype airplanes. None of them were piloted. So, I mean, that's why you do that, because they can push the envelope, and that's what they're trying to do. But you know, now you get the infrastructure. People are like, yeah, we're really excited about this, but like, I don't see these flying yet. FAA hasn't certified them yet. So, I mean, as an investor, I could see that. So I keep telling the people on the in the communities and the infrastructure, these guys are going to start at an airport. Stop worrying about, how am I going to get charging stations at the airport? Stop all that nonsense. If you go to any airport today, how do airplanes get fueled? Do they go up to a gas pump? They do not. They do not go up to a gas pump. They have a truck that has gas in it that comes up to them and fills them up. And then where does that truck get its gas? Not at the airport. It goes off and gets gas where there's like a big distribution of fuel for those trucks. We need to think of power and charging the exact same way, especially in these early days where, you know, if you make some big investment and say, yeah, Van Nuys is going to, you know, we're going to start operating in Van Nuys. And you, and so the infrastructure, that's a 5-year effort to get that infrastructure in. It takes 5 years to redesign a substation. And then it's $1 million a mile to move that power from that new substation design to wherever it's going. So you've had this, you know, 5 years and hundreds of millions of dollars invested. Now you start operating at Van Nuys and somebody's like, nope, 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 shut it down. We don't like it. You know, this is, we didn't sign up for this. And you just lost that much money. I mean, I saw a company put in just a concrete helipad. So, I mean, you know, just say 50 feet by 50 feet of concrete that costs $500,000. It's not, and that's it. It was nothing fancy. It was concrete. They put it right by their headquarters. And then they did that first. And then an old folks home, you know, showed up like a few miles away. That's in the path that they go to land at that helipad. And those guys are like, no, no, this is ridiculous. We're not going to, you're trying to nap during the day. I don't want to hear this helicopter. So that's $500,000 they just threw away. I mean, this is so, it's so real how important bringing the community along in this stuff is. So we really need to start educating people, I guess, now, but they really have to hear. They, like, you know, these companies need to like take a vehicle and basically go do like a road show and just show people like, hey, this is what it looks with the pilot in it and hear how, you know, it's not loud. And so the supply chain, I mean, these companies are still trying to establish a supply chain. So like on the batteries that we use for X57, they literally use like these little things look like Duracell batteries and their form factor is 18650. Doesn't mean anything to anybody, but that is like a standard that's been used for a long time. That supply chain is running out of having, you know, millions or billions of these cells tested and ready to, you know, go to the different companies. So there's another company that's making a different form factor. Well, that's got to get a whole bunch of research back behind it to prove it's safe before you're going to package it and put it on these aircraft. And so there's a lag of the supply chain because everybody's like, is this a real industry yet? And so it's really tough, you know, to show like, I have the products, you know, we can make so many of these aircraft. Motors get really hot and the controller for them get really hot and those things wear out really quick. So there's not a lot of longevity information on all these technologies. So, you know, for what the supply chain even needs to have ready for them is still kind of, you know, and being iterated on. So there's really a lot of things that have to come around. So on the infrastructure, so here I'm saying like, yeah, we're all used to cars going up to that. And if you're in a little GA airport and there's one or two operations, certainly that's what you're going to do. You're going to go to a pump. But when you're at the big airport, you're going to get this truck. So what a lot of people don't realize is so up in the Antelope Valley, that's where I am. How many solar panels do we have up there now? I have lost count, but hundreds of square miles. And then we have all the windmills. And I just happened to talk to somebody that works for SoCal Edison. And he said, you know, that the power that they make up there, it loses about 15 to 20% of all that energy made just transporting that through the ground to its destination. So why wouldn't we just have a bunch of big gigantic batteries parked next to those, taking that energy and then making money off that energy and not, you know, not needing to pump so much down through the lines. Also, people don't realize our train system is actually an extension of our power grid, or can be an extension of our power grid. I mean, obviously we move oil or fuel on that, but there's also electric power that we can move to not only like generate power for those trains, but be collecting energy as they're transporting those trains. So, so people need to like kind of be thinking back to, you know, how are we using our train system? How does it need to transform in this new industry, electrification. And the other thing that I learned was that if you do transport batteries, specifically lithium ion, I guess, and large amounts, they can only be charged to 30% state of charge. So they don't want them have any kind of thermal runaways with a whole bunch of batteries together. So that doesn't really help. But even for these portable trucks that have a battery, they can just, you know, they could just go to a substation that has the available power. So you don't have to like redesign a substation. So yeah, maybe you can transport them 30% state of charge, and maybe that's on highways. But if they can go, you know, wherever, like around the cities, and get recharged, that's great. But we don't have to use lithium ion batteries for these portable trucks. You could use any kinds of energy storage. Did I put one of them in here? Yeah. So one of them that I've been investing in for a while is a nano electroflow cell. So this is liquid. It's a liquid fuel. It's an electrolyte, and it has these little nanoparticles that are charged. The fuel cell just works like fuel cells have been around for a long time, but the intellectual property is in the actual nano-sizing these electric particles. There's nothing in the system that is explosive. So I can take the negative and positive liquid. I can pour them together. You see a couple degrees energy change. If there was a fire, you know, from some accident and this liquid would have come out, it would put the fire out. The charging time is another big thing with all these electric cars, electric airplanes. The charging time for these would be just a matter of pumping the not energized fuel out and then repumping in energized fuel. You don't have to have these big, heavy wire cables all over the aircraft, because with lithium-ion batteries, they have this form factor that can only fit in like certain spots on an airplane. With liquid fuel, you can have like shaped fuel tanks like you can in airplanes or cars today. And when you're running that fuel to go electrify something, it's just the fuel. You don't have to run the power lines necessarily to where you need the electrification to happen, which is right at the motor. So we started to look at this as being a replacement for lithium ion in the aircraft because, let's see, it was like, say, 20, I don't know, 16 or 17, our small little company of three people designed a battery that blew up on our first test. And I said, and our airplane is going to be piloted. And the first thing I asked was, has our test pilot seen this video yet? Because that was just one box of like 50 boxes that's going to be behind him with that amount of energy in it. So then I'm thinking, is there any energy storage solution out there that's not explosive? So I found this little company, like literally, again, two or three people in Chicago, Illinois, that started this idea, and they came out from some of the national labs, energy labs out there. But we said, hey, your energy density right now is like perfect for infrastructure. Why don't we use it for portable charging and infrastructure? And you can have, you know, these fuel tanks in the ground that's either charged, you know, it's charging the fuel that's been deposited and it's got, you know, new fuel. And so it's got its like own little ecosystem from an infrastructure standpoint. Like you literally, where we have oils piping in the ground, right? This is a liquid fuel too. So you want to replace, you know, oil with this fuel, you could. So like there's infrastructure to even, you know, mass transit it around where we already have oil and fuel. So NASA had a, you know, yeah. The liquid is like an electrolyte. So, I mean, it's when I say electrolyte, I mean, it's like Gatorade, right? It's just a water-based soluble, and it has these little iron particles in it. So the consistency of it looks like blood because it's iron. So, or rust, like maybe a little less red than blood. And the way a fuel cell works is, you know, you're basically pumping this fluid around, and when it hits these substrates, then it energizes this plate, and this plate becomes a positive, and this plate on the other side becomes a negative. So part of the liquids are, you know, positive. You know, one side of the liquid's like been positive intercharged, and the other liquid actually isn't. The iron is the positive side, and then I forgot what color the other side is, but it doesn't have the iron particles per se. But anyway, so a fuel cell is very classical. They've been around forever. It's just what they've used for the liquid in the fuel cell is what's different than other fuel cells. So we put some agreements in place. So this has been another really hard piece for NASA in regards to partners, and usually we fund people, like we put them on a contract and we give them a set of requirements and, you know, we need you to get this job done. But it's just too, there's having an ecosystem, there's just, it, that's going to take a lot of money to pull together like an operational demo between like having, you know, aerospace research, a vehicle, the infrastructure, you know, all the autonomy research we have to do, the detect and avoid and the sensors that go with it. So we said, let's just try this out. Let's do these non-reimbursable agreements. And so people should think about it like, okay, you bring a week of flight time. Maybe that cost your company $1 million, but this company's bringing $1 million. This company's bringing 5 million. NASA's bringing 20 million, but you put all these different partners together and everybody has like, you know, quadrupled their money that they brought to it or more than that. Because of how expensive it is to bring these operations on. That has been really hard for us because it's hard to keep a schedule to say we're going to do something by this time because everybody's like, well, I have a certification, you know, project on my airplane. And so when we have time to fit you in a window, we'll fit you in. Well, that's hard to plan with a whole bunch of other partners. So we started that out and we got some aerospace partners. So people are doing the software piece for aerospace operations, and we did get some vehicle partners. And then we did have some partners with a few communities here you can see listed, just for them to start thinking, like kind of, yeah, think about everybody right now is already thinking multimodal. I mean, you look at LAX is definitely, or LA is making a big transformation in, right, the how to get to the metros, opening up LAX so like you're not stuck in that stupid circle for an hour just to drop somebody off. Right. And we got, I don't know if you guys have been following what they're doing down there, but they got a big rental car facility. So they have a tram going there. So, you know, you have one place to go on a tram, and just opening up the multimodal capability. I mean, even down to the little scooters. So the little scooters, I mean, it's more than just picking up a scooter. They actually have, what do they refer to it as? It's like digital rules they have. So those scooters are electronic. They know who gets them, where they're going. The city that is open software for the city to know exactly where all those vehicles are. And they can basically put rules in place like a geofence. I don't know if anybody's heard of a geofence, but it's like some digital wall. Like, okay, these little scooters can be in this area, but as soon as it gets past the street, it's going to die. Like the power will go out, because we don't want these in certain parts of the community. So that, you know, those digital planning that they're doing there, you know, is kind of making strides into this whole like digital platform of not just multimodal on the ground, but obviously it'll like Joby has an airspace capability, right? They have an app. So cars will pick you up and take you to, they know exactly when a Joby vehicle is going to land at, you know, whichever airport and get you guys all situated. So really we just brought these cities on just to say, you know, educate, like, you know, we're aerospace people, educate us on city planning, what you plan to do and how do we integrate these operations in the cities. Yeah, so this, we put this request proposal out probably in 2020 and got people on contract in 2021. Again, there was no funds exchanged, but more information exchange. So, you know, back in 2020, you know, how many people even had heard of advanced air mobility yet? Or, you know, I think probably there's enough of these companies in California that California is already involved in these discussions. And so, If anything, I, you know, sometimes these people do these proposals to get the NASA visibility, right? It just kind of brings more visibility to their county, but or their city. So, I mean, if you're having enough of that engagement, you know, especially we're in, you know, LA County area, I think there's just enough of that information exchange going on. You know, as we heard, you're helping out with Joby or looking at vertiports or whatever, different places. So. I don't know if they're going to do another solicitation for this kind of, the city integration piece. They just did a reorganization at NASA of how they're funding all the advanced air mobility stuff. So things got slowed down for a little bit, but we can just do this. Like, I mean, I had set up quarterly meetings with Selena when she was at Department of Transportation, you know, running Department of Transportation for LA. And we would just have quarterly meetings like, hey, this is what we're doing. You know, we're trying to talk to LAWA, you know, what are you guys doing for the Olympics? So it doesn't take a formal agreement for us to have these kind of discussions and strategize together. And then just for the small businesses in the room, if you're not aware of the NASA Small Business Initiative Research Program, you know, they have different calls they do every year of different topics. I think they're starting to have, like, usually they're very aircraft centric, but I think they're starting to look at some of the airspace and infrastructure pieces that maybe in some of the calls. So and some of these things, you know, the language is pretty broad that you kind of can propose, you know, various different ideas into these for the aviation sector. So so this is basically this phase one is like to get your foot in the door just to see if you're legit in, you know, your company and what you can do, and just write just like your business ethics, following through with what you said you're going to do. And then, you know, if you get researchers that are rallied around your company, right, then they'll be on the review for a phase two that you put in, which is really much more substantial amount of money. Once you get your foot in the door for a phase one, though, you can turn any of those contracts into a phase three. So when I started with those little, you know, two, three people companies, they had just gotten like initial phase one. So like, that's just like their foot in the door, NASA, but me working with them and you know, seeing their excitement, what they could bring into the table, and their, you know, the small businesses put a lot of their own time into this kind of stuff, like versus every little requirement being specified and paid for, because they're just trying to make it, they're trying to grow their company. So they really have the incentive to work harder and put more time in than every dollar maybe that has to be spent. But anyways, if a NASA project has some money, they can just take those phase one contracts into multi-million dollar contracts. If it works out that way. So I just wanted to mention that because I figured there'd be some small businesses here. Okay. So that's it in a little nutshell.